So welcome back to the podcast, Jeff. We're going to talk about company culture, and then we're also going to talk about it in the context of a post-COVID world. So company culture is so critical. There's a saying, I guess the famous management guru Peter Drucker said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And he wasn't saying that strategy is not important. Strategy is very important, but strategy is not enough if your culture is not going to support that. And so let's talk about this, especially for small companies that are just starting to grow, starting to maybe add their first few employees. The culture is really important.
1,000%. So I've been thinking about this, you know, since you mentioned the topic, or sort of two different parallels, right? So one is just kind of what we know about culture, right? And, you know, I can tell you that one of the things that a lot of senior leaders hate doing, they think it's me doing this psycho mumble BS, is the values, the mission, the vision. But like, darn it, like that's important, because decisions begin with your values and your mission, right? And your vision and your priorities. And how we make decisions impacts culture, and culture impacts the decisions that we make. And it has to start with values. What are the values of the company? And quite frankly, what are your values as leaders?
Yeah, that's important. The values really set the tone. And then that also should, but doesn't always, drive behavior. And so I think some of the things that people get a little caught up on is they might read that they need to be more innovative. They need to be doing this, that, and the other thing. And maybe that's even part of their cultural values. But historically, maybe they grew up in an environment where that was not rewarded. And so they revert back to just behaviors that they've adopted or acquired throughout their life. How does someone recognize when that's happening? Because that's a critical part in making sure that the culture then can permeate in the company.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, if you're thinking it, so are they. Mm-hmm. That, right? And, you know, so often, you know, particularly organizations don't have psychological safety, right? And they could be ones where everyone seems to just get along and smile, but then they talk behind each other's back, or, you know, or they don't. There's a lot of, you know, fighting, right? Either one of those obviously is not healthy. And each one of those people are thinking, well, that's not working, or that person's a jerk, or like, I don't feel comfortable saying this. Mm-hmm. And so so what do you do about that, right? So here's a really easy quote technique. If you're in a meeting and you're like, this seems weird, do I say something? Like, aren't we, you know, feeding into this sort of negative culture? Just ask the question. Raise awareness in the room. Don't judge, just get curious, and get curious out loud. Hey, folks, I don't know, I'm just going to give an example. Like, you know, I noticed that, well, you give me an example, and then I'll give you, give me an example of where you've seen bad culture, however you want to frame it. And then let me give you an example of what to do in the moment around that.
Fair enough. I've seen this in several situations with other executives that are looking to build their companies, and they'll talk about hiring the best people, but then they tell them everything they need to be doing. And usually when you hire the best people, and Steve Jobs has said this before, we don't hire people to the best people to tell them what to do. We hire the best people so they can tell us what to do. So there's situations where a leader might be hiring really, really high quality people, really solid people, but then they go tell them everything to do. It's a bit of a micromanaging type of approach. And so that actually will separate people who want to be managed very well, yes, to the people who are like, look, I know what I'm doing, let me do it, and we're going to collectively prosper. So recommendations on that one.
Yeah, training, coaching, mentoring, you know, because as you know, particularly, you know, you came up through the sort of technical space of leadership, right? And we see that a lot. I mean, any job starts generally, there's a technical aspect to most jobs, right? And then you get really good at doing your job. So you climb the ranks, and then lo and behold, you get less good at doing your jobs, right? But you don't want anybody to know, right? You know, in one of our earlier podcasts, we talked about imposter syndrome, right? You know, so you sort of try to fake it till you make it. That, by the way, my friend, is actually where you start seeing erosions in culture, is because everybody's I'm fine with fake it till you make it, but could you actually be honest that we're all faking it till we make it, right? And so you get into these management leadership roles and you're not great at it because maybe you haven't had the training, the coaching, the models, right? The supervision, that kind of thing. And so then you get back to what you just said. You get back to micromanaging. You get back to doing other people's jobs for them. Then they get frustrated and then you end up saying, I can't get good people. Well, that's because you keep doing their job for them.
You know, there's another scenario. So I'll give this example. Small companies that are fast growth really work hard. They really work hard. Their executives are working evenings, weekends, but oftentimes that's not something that the rest of the staff wants to do, has the mindset to do. And oftentimes the company doesn't even like promote that. No, no, we've got great work-life balance. Yet you're getting a whole bunch of emails from your leaders on Saturdays with questions. And I've seen situations where staff will think, oh my gosh, I got to reply. So then they're taking time off of their Saturday, which is, it's a conflict with what the company said was their values, great work-life balance. I know what I did in this situation because I've had it happen. Tell me what you would recommend to people. I'll share mine in a moment.
Okay, so two things, but it's very analogous to when we try to create a good habit for ourselves, but we overshoot the goal, right? Like, okay, like I'm going to replace all chips with fruits and vegetables or something. And then one day you find yourself having chips, right? And then so now you're just lying. So the two things, be honest, right? Be really honest with yourself and with each other about what you can do around work-life balance. And then I would say find one or two structures that everybody can truly commit to. So for example, how about, you know, while we aspire to no emails, whatever, past 6 o'clock on Friday, how about definitely no emails till Sunday? And if you can make a game out of you get dinged if an email goes out on Sunday that doesn't say the building's on fire, which, by the way, I hope is not an email. It's something a little bit more urgent. So you can have a fun way of doing it. But quite frankly, you talk about startups, work-life balance is a tough one.
It's a hard thing to come by. So the way I dealt with work-life balance in the startups that I've built is I wasn't going to slow down. I needed to keep working. I had a mission. I wanted to, get this company big, get it off the ground and prosper. So I wasn't going to stop working after 6. I wasn't going to stop working in the evenings. I would put my kids to bed, start working at 9 o'clock till whenever I needed to go to bed and then work on the weekends. And so what happened was I started getting staff that was a little bit uncomfortable with my Saturday emails asking questions. So I had a conversation that went like this. When I send you an email that is after hours, I am not looking for you to reply right away unless I send you something that is like really critical, like, and I'll notate that urgent. Can you get back to me? Or if it really is urgent, I'll text you, and I will not text you unless it is really, really important on the weekends. And so that gave the staff a lot of comfort that, okay, like this is just Raj being Raj. He's just sending his emails, sending his questions. I'll get to them on Monday morning. And that made a really big difference in people's lives to help them feel it.
Listen, 1,000%. The problem that you run into often is that even when you set that as a rule, right? But you notice that Bob always responds to your emails. And quite frankly, you like that Bob. You know what I mean? But you know, it's important to have work-life balance.
It's always Bob.
Right. Well, exactly. And so, you know, the reality is we still got to wrestle with it, right? But I agree 1,000%.
True. I mean, there's, you're not going to be able to fix it 100%, but like that really helped us go a long way. I know my team felt much better about it. Some of them would still reply. But you just got to continue that open conversation, to make sure that your culture is what you want it to be.
That's right. And negotiate, right? So you want A, you want B, how do we meet each other's needs in a way that makes sense?
Right. Yeah.
So, for example, you could have said, okay, well, I'll stop doing emails on Saturday, or okay, I'll save all my emails and draft and then have them go out. But you would have never quite felt satisfied, because it's like you can't check that off the list because it's not really out there yet. You'd be waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning, darn it, and hitting send. Right. And so,
yeah.
And so, so that was a good way of negotiating. Look, I'm still going to go ahead and send those emails, you know, but please don't feel compelled to reply. And I'll put NNTR in the subject line if it, you know, no need to reply, you know, or I'm going to type urgent, or I'm going to text you and say, I just sent you, I did this to my admin the other day. I texted, I said, I just sent you an email. I need you to take a look at it. Right. Because otherwise I didn't need that kind of timeliness. Yeah.
And there's going to be times when you've got people who have different life situations. One of your staff members might have kids and is really busy in the evenings and weekends taking care of the family. Others might be single and maybe have more time and are open to replying back. So you've got different situations. And it's really about open communication. Jeff, there's another scenario too. I mean, there's many scenarios about culture building that I think companies experience. So in addition to this, sending emails and requests all different hours, it's how you respond to customers. Sometimes managers, let me rephrase this. Sometimes companies say that they want their products to have a lot of quality behind them. And sometimes to deliver on that quality, it takes a bit of extra time. Yet managers are pushed oftentimes by leaders to perform at certain productivity levels. Could be sales teams that have to hit certain numbers in order to grow because they've made certain promises to the investors, that kind of stuff. It gets very competitive and can become a very high pressure situation. So that's another situation here. Like, how do you manage that cultural gap where your company says our products have a lot of quality, they're great products, yet the staff just does not have the bandwidth to deliver that high quality promise, because there's so much pressure on productivity as opposed to.
Well, okay. Quality. So first of all, you know, one of the things I was thinking about earlier was this idea of having mixed incentive structure. That's a good way to destroy a culture, right? Is when you have incentives that conflict with one another. In that case, you know, when I talk about values, it's what are the probably top three, not even like five, but let's say three, right, that you're going to live and die on. And if quality is truly a value, then you need to be able to die on that grave, right? So you need to get a good communications person about how to communicate to the stakeholders about, like, we are not going to compromise quality, and look for ways to support, to make sure that that's true, to make sure that you get what you need to get out. And maybe it does mean, you know, you lag behind with your competitor, but if your competitor is just pumping out poor quality, maybe you look bad in the short run, but ultimately you succeed because you maintained quality and did not give in to the pressure.
And I think one of the things that it's really important that leaders know is that the values that you put forth and the culture that you create that enables your team to address those values ties into your brand. So when you think about Walmart, what is the first thing you think about Walmart? Cheap prices, right? Nobody thinks, oh, I'm going to go to Walmart to buy something of really high quality. I mean, maybe some people do, but it's pretty much you go there because it's low cost. Whereas if you wanted to go shop at, I don't know, Louis Vuitton, you're not thinking I'm paying a low cost here. You're thinking, oh, it's brand reputation. There's lots of other things. And so that's really important too, that your staff knows and lives by what that value is, because that protects your brand.
Right. So when you talk about culture, I think of what we're talking about a lot now is how do we make decisions, right? And what's the values, the spoken and unspoken values? There's also things like the structures, like, you know, there's the organizational structure, right? So how are you structuring the organization? Like, what culture are you sort of emulating or supporting? There's a physical structure, like literally, like, what does your furniture look like? Right. You know, like,
yeah.
Right. Like, all, you know, there's that, right. You walk into a building, you immediately start to have a certain feeling that's tied into the culture.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, so if anybody's been into a Salesforce building, they're very similar in design on the inside. You just feel like staying there because it's just so well designed, really nice, the layouts, all kinds of stuff. I was fortunate enough to be at one for a partnership thing in San Francisco. And up at the very top floor, you can see all of San Francisco. You can get a cappuccino. You can get some really like gourmet food and everything like that. And they really treat their customers, their partners well. They always take them up to that floor. It's just part of the experience of going to the Salesforce building. They're not the cheapest product on the market. They're pretty pricey. But they do this because that's part of their brand. You know, you feel like, okay, I'm paying for this, but you know, you feel
that's right. And so, it, you know, whenever they have quarters that they're really feeling pressure to cut costs, you know, every once in a while it might come up, do we like stop the cappuccinos or do we replace it with, you know, like this cheap stuff? And, you know, there's a decision to be made by, you know, perhaps a director level person, right? But this is why you don't just set the culture, you know, according to values and mission and things like that, but you then have to teach it, communicate it, and empower people to make those right decisions. So the person, for example, doesn't get dinged, you know, for not taking advantage of low-hanging fruit to reduce cost, because they would lose that experience of look how, you know, that experience that you got as a partner coming in, but also, you know, it says like, look, we're successful.
Yeah. And I think there's this other side of this, and this gets a little touchy with some companies, and that is who is on their management team and what does that look like physically? What does that look like? Is it all one gender, one race, if you will? Is it a mixture? What level of diversity do you have inside your company? And I know that, you know, there are companies that we see there's harassment lawsuits and things like that where behaviors were tolerated by management for so long. I mean, that's part of company culture too, and it really needs to be like, you know, stopped right at the top.
Yeah, well, you know, my thing is leading with heart. That's not gonna. I mean, you're watching those cards fall very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't not have diversity in your, you know, among your folks these days for very long. And then you really have to find ways to have equitable around decisions and pay and the other types of things, and having people feel really included, not just like the token, you know, non-white male person.
And you'd be surprised that even in this day and age, that still is an issue. I guess the term is unconscious bias. You don't even know it's happening. You don't know it's occurring. I give you an example. There's one company that had a call. It's a medium-sized company that had a call with people about how they wanted to really take this, improve their culture of diversity, especially in the higher ranks. And their goal was to have something like a 5 or 6% diverse workforce by the end of the year. And I think so many people
like what?
Looked at that as like, what year is this? 5%? Are you kidding me? That's it? That's your goal?
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, and when management just said this as if, yes, this is our good goal, it was just, a lot of people were just kind of taken aback, and people just from that comment, people left the company because they knew that they weren't taking this really seriously.
Well, there's a couple of things. There's also reality is that this has been going on for so long. There's an organization I've been working with for a bunch of years, and it's a multi-billion-dollar organization. I won't talk about the industry, but they just, they were in the last 6 months have been searching for a new CEO. And it was clear, you know, clear that the board was looking for a diverse candidate. So they just last week announced the new hire, an older white male. And so the recruiting company said it's slim pickings. Like, the problem is that, you know, people have been squished down for so long that, you know, at the most senior levels, there's not a lot of competition. Now that's changing. But so as an organization who knows that you have to and is taking action around DE&I kind of stuff, you really need to look at all levels. And it's not just about bringing in, you know, people at the most senior levels, but it certainly is that. But it's also, what are you doing internally to coach, mentor, and support, you know, folks, and to give opportunities and, you know, the kind of the support that they need.
You know, I one time years ago at one of my companies, it was growing fast. We had offices in different countries, and And one of my managers, female managers, came to me and said a new person that we had hired recently was trying to push some of his work onto a peer who was also female. And I was like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Everybody's got the same workload. And he said, and she was saying that, yeah, this seems to be a bit of an issue. This guy has some issue working with women.
Right.
And I was like, fire him right now. And we got rid of him. And that did so much because it showed the rest of the team that we're not going to tolerate that kind of nonsense. Absolutely not going to tolerate that kind of nonsense. It empowered the leadership that I had in place. And we were able to actually hire much better quality people as a result of it. I think that swift action, when you start to see things, is also really indicative. Because they could tell it wasn't like we were reacting to, right. Oh, we've got pressure from the top. This is the move we should make. That it was very architected. It was like just so natural that they understood that that actually is the culture, is we're going to be fair to everybody.
Well, and right. And that's where it gets, first of all, there's managerial courage that goes out because there was no, right. So if you took the time to actually do the investigation to make sure, well, is this accurate?
We did all that, you know.
Right. Cause my guess is you sort of had, it probably didn't come out of the blue either, right? Like, you know, your managers, you know, I would assume, right?
Yeah. Well, in this particular situation, I mean, the details would be that we were observing a certain behavior in somebody over their first 2 weeks of being hired. And it, and so the deeper we dug, found out that there were some issues
exactly.
there. I did not want that part of the culture at all. I wanted swift action, and we took it.
So I was thinking of, you just got these like six things, right? When it comes to like, you know, culture. And if you're looking to really be proactive around culture, and the first one is actually, it's three, it's listen and then listen and then listen. And, you know, and like, that's a really good example of listening, right? You know, listen to your folks, right? Right now, you have different generations, right? You have folks from different races, different backgrounds, different skill sets, right? And, you know, there's a tendency, particularly for people of different generations, to judge the other generation, right? We get so stuck in our judgment. So here's my tip. One of my tips of the day here is replace judgment with curiosity.
It's a good tip, Jeff. Give me an example.
Okay. So there's a leader I've worked with, and we found out one of his top strengths is curiosity, right? So by a particular assessment. And this person so this is one example. There's one. So this person would kept getting stuck by the millennial generation folks in the workplace. They're lazy, you know, et cetera.
He had that mindset.
Absolutely. Like some, right. And had all this data to back it up. Right. So
I said,
all right, so get curious, right? So start having a conversation, right? And the reality is that everybody has something to learn from each other. Like, hey, you know, I don't like to stereotype, but like one of the things that the younger generation is showing more passion around than the older generation is really insisting on having a sense of purpose in the work they do. They want to feel emotionally connected to the work and the manager. So when you replace judgment with curiosity, you talk about cultural shift. It's like, wow, what if we as an organization like shifted and were like purpose driven with all our decisions, and like all of a sudden, like this infinite amount of possibilities come up about what could be done. And lo and behold, what was good for these millennials was also good for, you know, the other folks. So that's an example.
I have another example to share, and you're right. There's definitely a generational a gap where sometimes an older generation would judge a younger generation, but it's also, it goes the other way too. And so there's one story where a new CEO was hired into a young company. I shouldn't say new, he was a seasoned CEO. And he came in, and the guy came in dressed nicely, not wearing a tie,
right.
tech, but he was dressed really nicely, pressed shirt, all that right. kind of stuff. And the culture of the company was, we're wearing t-shirts and jeans.
Exactly.
And so one of the younger team members actually went up and said, so what do you actually do here? To the CEO. right? So,
That's great.
you know, and
That's great.
it was just an eye opener for the CEO to just look at that and say, you know,
That's great. To the only person that was actually, you know, dressed,
yeah, wearing, you know, a dry clean shirt, you know,
clothes, so, right?
And then there's another situation I remember where one executive of a growing company, it's an established traditional company, they hired a younger person to be one of the managers, who was a total go-getter, whippersnapper, all that kind of stuff. And so this older gentleman kept asking this new leader to come to his house for dinner with the family and get to meet. And the younger generation guy just couldn't understand, what is this? Like,
right.
Why is he doing that? And so it turns out that that's part of the generational gap, that in some corporate environments, traditional corporate environments, older gentlemen, that was the thing. That was what you did in the, I don't know, 60s, 70s, maybe even the 80s. I don't know. And so the younger guy could not get his head around that. So going from judgment to understanding, why is he asking me out to dinner with his wife? That's just a thing. You know, like if you look back at these sitcoms, like the Dick Van Dyke Show or something,
right,
that kind of stuff is on TV. It happened all the time, right? It's not a thing today.
Isn't it hard to watch some of these old sitcoms and not cringe these days with the level of awareness that we have now?
I mean, it's
interesting. I mean, they're definitely used in classrooms, you know, to talk about the shifts, right?
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that I was making, one of the other six things is like really including everybody in decisions around the culture, like what's working, what's not working, what can we do to improve the culture, right? How are we going to measure success and make sure that you have that constant feedback loop, you know, through, you know, surveys, cultural audits, things like that, but also just through dialogue and make sure that you have plays. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if there was like, you know, the culture club, and I don't mean the band, you know, where like, you know, folks got together and talking about their culture and just giving voice to it and language to it. And then maybe come that, you know, proposing a set of actions that the organization can take, you know, a little bit at a time, right? Nothing changes overnight. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. And, you know, it's not that difficult. It's just that, you know, folks are so darn busy, right? We're already sort of stressed out, overworked, you know, underpaid, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's so critical. And if you have a really positive culture and psychological safety and all that, then what you find is work gets done much more efficiently and effectively because communication and collaboration is much better.
I just want to tie it back again to like the brand again, because I feel like the culture and the brand are very closely connected, because like the culture helps create that brand also. So for example, when you think of financial institutions, you typically think of fairly professional coat and tie, perhaps wearing kind of, you know, thing that like, that's how they go to work. I mean, maybe that's shifting a little bit now, but you know, to some degree, they're still the ones with the dry clean shirts. Whereas you go to an environment of say, a young, fast tech startup that's just killing it, and their whole brand is very different. And maybe it's playful. Maybe the language they use on their website, it's more playful. And just that alone will attract a different type of person who wants that type of culture versus the more traditional financial services company type of culture. So I think everything that you do, from the messaging that you create, the colors that you choose for your, like you said, your office environment, the furniture, everything ties in to that, the cultural aspect. So it's a very deep.
And I would say, you know, a lot of times I'll get on the leadership development plan, adapt to the culture, right? And so they bring in a leader, they bring in who they want. I mean, who they need, but not who they want, right? And so oftentimes it's somebody with different sort of cultural experiences, cultural background. Yeah, and I'm not talking about race per se, you know, I'm talking about usually experience and things like that, is what the organization needs, you know. So for example, if everyone's like all playful and stuff, they might need somebody that's, you know, says, hey guys, we got to work, right? and being able to sort of help that person move the organization, I keep saying this, incrementally, right? Because if they try to do the, I had a call, that today. This is a timeless podcast, but you know, and literally we were talking, this guy was brought in, right? And wasn't adapting to the younger culture, a tech startup, it's the exact situation you talked about. Mm-hmm. And he has done remarkable in adapting to that. And basically one of his things, literally on his plan, is to stop acting like he's the smartest guy in the room, even if he thinks he is, right? And withhold his, quote, wonderful expertise, right? Making sure that he's collaborating with and working with and bringing out the expertise of the folks around him.
That's really important, is to just, you know, be a little bit more humble about you, what you know. It'll come out in time, just in your conversations. People know that you're smart and you don't need to like spell it out to people, right? I find that a little bit off-putting also. You know, there's another thought that popped in my head as you were talking about the culture. Oh gosh, it's escaping me right now.
Bringing in who you need, not who you want.
Yeah, thanks for trying to trigger my memory. I guess as I get older, I'm forgetting a little bit. Bringing in who you need. Well, you know, tell you what, it'll come back to me.
You know, one of the other important things is to communicate, right? Setting expectations. So for example, again, if you're trying to, you know, talked about culture in post-COVID world, right? And so, you know, some of the culture change has been forced upon us, right? And then some, and now it's like to do a little audit. What do we want to, just talking about this recently with the organization, what do we want to keep and what do we want to let go of in terms of lessons learned, right, from the forced learning that everyone had to do? And what I would say, though, is if you're gonna, you know, continue to make some changes, make sure that you set expectations and tell people to expect failure. We're not going to get this right. This is a kind of continuous improvement thing. So we're going to make some changes based on input that we've gotten from you, and then we want some continual feedback, but we need everybody to contribute to try to help make sure it makes this successful, right? And you know, but you know, this idea of not just delivering change without any type of, you know, pre, during, and post communication is a good way to completely fail a great plan.
I did remember what I wanted to share, and that is actually
In your face, by the way.
You could see it in my face. There's one line I found to be very effective. I didn't come up with it. I learned it along the way when I was being professionally coached. It's a very effective line when someone on your team does something that just is not part of your culture, that it could be they showed up late for work and they do that consistently. It could be maybe the way they designed something. It just wasn't consistent with the rest of the company culture. And that line is, you have it one-on-one, not in public. You just say, we don't do that here.
Yeah.
That's it. And so it's so simple. It's to the point. And I think, you know, 9 times out of 10, someone will get the message really quickly. And if they're not a cultural fit, then you want to coach them out of the company, because that will destroy your environment. I've seen situations where people have a really highly productive person and they just keep them on the team because they think, oh man, they're just producing so much. What they're really doing, though, is they're destroying part of your other, the productivity of your other team members. And if you just let go of that one person and brought in somebody that's a better cultural fit, everybody collectively will improve.
Yeah, it's a great one. And it also speaks to the importance of having such a strong culture that anybody that's been there for a while could make that comment and feel okay making it.
Yeah.
Right. Because if, you know, if you're a manager, right, you know, of, I don't know, a 2000 employee organization, maybe not, you feel comfortable making that, but you do feel comfortable. I think who does this really well is rehab centers, right? Like you have this, like, you know, addict that comes in fighting and screaming and being the new delinquent, but everyone's like loving and supportive and holding people accountable for their behavior, right? And the way that they speak. And they quickly, it's such a strong culture, they quickly learn to have to adapt. And anybody there could say, yeah, we don't do that here.
Yeah. That's really important, because they feel empowered. They really feel like they're part of that community, that company. And we all seek being part of a community. There's another thing also, and this ties a bit to marketing and culture. I adapted this from one of my former clients, which was a Sally Beauty Supply, really large beauty supply chain in the country. And so if someone was to buy a product that they wanted to resell on the team, or if they wanted to create a product, they would always say, what would Sally say?
Right. And
what that meant, it wasn't Sally like the head of the company or something. Sally was actually the persona of their ideal client.
Yeah, that's right.
And that person had characteristics, you know, married with two kids, you know, soccer, family, whatever it is, you know, they like, this is the type of house they own. This is where they went on vacations. Would they buy this product? Because that was their persona. That was who they sold to. And they knew exactly who they sold to. I think many companies get caught thinking that they can sell what they've got to everybody, you know, and it's okay to have multiple personas. Nothing wrong with that. But when you develop a product, when you refine something, add a feature, will Sally buy this is the question you want to ask. And when you do that, look at through that lens, that really changes the culture. And I remember one of my greatest achievements that I thought was when one of my staff members, when we were talking about a new feature we're going to build, they said, I don't think Sally would like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, all right. Culture is now permeating the company. They understand. Yeah.
Well, and language, right? It has to be accessible, the language, right? That was so easy to say, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why a lot of work is done with mission, getting mission statements down to be like so succinct.
Yeah.
Right. So what would say? So let me ask you this as we start coming to a close. What's a word or a phrase that describes your culture of your podcasts?
Facts tell, stories sell. And I try to make sure that when we're explaining things that we provide examples, because I think we all learn better through examples, through stories. And so anybody that has ever worked for me can tell, I'll tell you, that's one of my favorite lines. I actually lead through one-liners. And to your point, they're very succinct. They're very to the point. And that is one of my favorite ones. I didn't come up with it, but I use it all the time. Facts tell, yep. Stories sell.
That's
all
great.
Right. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for joining us today on this podcast about culture. Till next time.
Yeah, great to be with you.